first, I just want to introduce to everybody our esteemed panel to discuss our cases. And this is Peter Singer from USC and Mary Samuels from Oregon. Why did I say Oregon Health Sciences University. So, yeah, you know, when we're from the East Coast, we kind of, you know, we don't move over to this West Coast thing so much. So I just want to thank everyone who submitted cases to us because it was really great. We got a good number of cases. We have 5 cases here focusing on abnormalities of thyroid function. So that's what we're going to focus on right now. And the first case is going to be presented by David Cohen. Let's make sure they're...
Okay, great. My name is David Cohen. I'm a second-year fellow at LAC, USC. Medical Center, Los Angeles. This is a case that was called into our general endocrine consult service 2 months ago. It's a 29-year-old Chinese male who...
Yes?
Does Dr. Singer know the case already?
He does not know the case.
Okay. I'll make that clear.
It's a 29-year-old Chinese male with newly diagnosed hyperthyroidism who presented to the emergency room with new-onset bilateral low extremity paralysis. He actually developed these symptoms upon awakening that morning. 6 days prior to the presentation, he had presented to his primary medical doctor with complaints of palpitations, tremors, and muscle fatigue. Labs were drawn. This is according to him. We didn't have the labs at the time, but labs were drawn, and according to the patient, the TSH was suppressed less than 0.01, and he had a free T4 of 4.63. Doctor subsequently started him on methimazole 10 milligrams POBID and propranolol 10 milligrams POTID. And he states that he was approximately 50% compliant with these medications, with each of them. On the day prior to admission, he was in his usual state of health. He was outside working in the sun. It had been hot, greater than 100 degrees. And prior to going to dinner that night, prior to going to bed that night for dinner, he had a large bowl of spaghetti. When he woke up in the morning, he was completely unable to move his lower extremities, and he had some degree of weakness on his upper extremities. He noted that his sensation was completely intact. He had no problems with his respirations, and his mental status was also intact. He had also complained of some muscle cramps. He was otherwise asymptomatic. You want me to pause? Any questions? Keep going? So, you want me to get right to it?
Yeah, unless you don't want to.
Well, Dr. Singer likes the history and the physical, so I can go through the physical too. Let's see. So, otherwise, in the emergency room, so his blood pressure initially was, and, you know, and here it says a 157 over 52. And actually, when he first came in, his blood pressure was a little bit lower than that. It was about 110 over 50 when he first presented. His heart rate was 107 and regular. His respiratory rate was 18, and his oxygen saturation was 99% on room air. He was 5'9" and 161 pounds. The peak flow, which was obtained in the emergency room, was 650, which is normal. He was anxious and no respiratory distress. He had no evidence of proptosis, chemosis, lid lag, stare, or periorbital edema. Thyroid was diffusely enlarged, approximately 3 times the normal size. There's no bruit, no tenderness, and no nodularity. And he also had no lymphadenopathy in his neck. Cardiac exam was notable for tachycardia with regular rhythm and no murmur. His skin was warm, smooth, and moist. He had a mild tremor. Lower extremity strength was 0 out of 5 bilaterally. Upper extremity strength was 3 out of 5 bilaterally. Deep tendon reflexes were unable to be elicited in the lower extremities and 2 out of 2 in the upper extremities. Sensation was completely intact symmetrically and upper and lower, and cranial nerves were intact.
The question I had was, you mentioned that the thyroid is 3 times normal size, and, you know, it's a subjective measurement. Want to know how big is the normal thyroid? To hear from the audience, 15 grams, which was about right. Maybe in a male, maybe 12 grams. A woman, a little bit larger, 15 grams. Correct. Now, unless that gland is really big and juicy, unless it's a very large gland, you're not going to hear a bruit, and you didn't hear a bruit.
Didn't hear a bruit.
So, thank you.
So before we get to the specific diagnosis of what's going on in him, I'm still filling in the background picture in terms of his recent onset of thyrotoxicosis and perhaps the differential diagnosis of that. And I missed, does he have a family history
of
thyroid disease?
No family history of thyroid disease.
Other autoimmune diseases?
No autoimmune disease. He said he had an uncle who at the age of 45 died from an unknown muscle problem.
Okay. And you mentioned recent onset of palpitations, really no other history of thyrotoxic symptoms and the time period?
It was about 2 months of tremors and palpitations and some muscle fatigue.
So really nothing from before 2 months ago, because I'm obviously trying to get at the idea of we know he's thyrotoxic and we probably know what the connection of that is between with his paralysis. But then we have to get into the differential diagnosis of his thyrotoxicosis as well. And any kind of symptoms that are that recent could be silent thyroiditis, especially with not a very large goiter with no Brewy versus Graves' disease, things like that. So really you couldn't get anything from before about 2 months ago.
No, he was a healthy male, and he actually somebody who had seen doctors regularly prior to this.
And did you mention he's kind of on the thin side, 160 pounds, you said. Had he lost weight, or was that his regular physique?
Okay. Hadn't lost any weight, yeah. His BMI was about 24, 25.
Okay,
so I'll get to his lab findings. In the emergency room, the labs, and most importantly, his potassium was 1.6. His BUN was 19. His creatinine was 0.2. The rest of the chemistry and the liver function tests, which were all drawn at the time, were all within normal limits. A TSH that was drawn was less than 0.01. His free T4 was 3.73. And like I had said, it was the week before, 10 days before, it was 4.63, was his free T4 from outside.
Okay, bonus question. You said the creatinine is 0.2.
No, it's 0.82.
Oh, sorry. I have no questions. So what did you do then?
Well, the other notable thing, the finding, was an EKG, which showed ST depressions, tachycardia, which we knew. It showed U waves, and it also showed the concerning finding was a second-degree AV block. So
okay.
Our concern at the time was for thyrotoxic paralysis with hypokalemia. So the concern was how to treat his underlying etiology, his hyperthyroidism, and his increased catecholamine response in the setting of this hypokalemia while trying to avoid further complications later on, such as hyperkalemia. So we were concerned. There were a couple concerns. First was his cardiac issues. And so the two treatments we gave him for this were small doses of potassium in order to increase his potassium to a higher level without complicating it with hyperkalemia later on, and then also treating him with non-selective beta blockers to calm the catecholamine response and also treat his symptoms of tachycardia and tremulousness. We were a little more aggressive with his potassium repletion than we may have been otherwise, given his new or apparently new second-degree AV block. We're also a little concerned that the creatinine was a little bit higher than what we had anticipated it being. And in the setting of his blood pressure, like I said, when he came in, his systolic was really only about 110 over 50. We were concerned that he was a little more dehydrated and had some impending renal dysfunction. So we aggressively hydrated him as well.
What do you mean that he's a creatinine of 0.8 for a man with a BMR of 24 or 25? Sounds okay. So you thought the creatinine should be lower?
Well, with his hyperthyroidism and thyrotoxicosis, we expected the creatinine to be lower because you'd expect decreased conversion from creatine to creatinine.
And that was the bonus question that I didn't get to. And he's not a shill, by the way. He didn't set this up. But for your information, unless you're all aware of that, in patients with hyperthyroidism, creatinines tend to be lower because, as David mentioned, impairment of conversion of creatine to creatinine. That could possibly be a bonus. Could possibly be a board's question. Okay, Mary?
I'll take it. So thinking about this first from the diagnostic standpoint, it's really not a mystery. This is one of those aha diagnoses that really don't fit anything else. And in fact, I've read about this. So this is thyrotoxic periodic paralysis. I read about this just last week because it was the case of the week in the New York Times Sunday magazine. It might not be this case, but it sounded a lot like this case. You didn't send that in, did you?
I didn't, no.
Ah, okay. So those of you who want to go to a definitive reference source, last week's New York Times Sunday magazine has this case in it. And I don't know if you guys read the New York Times Sunday magazine, but they basically post a case every week on their website, and then they solicit guesses or input on what the correct diagnosis is, and then they print the case that Sunday, and they tell who the first person was who submitted the correct diagnosis. And any of us reading this would immediately know what this was, because again, this is one of those things where there really isn't a differential diagnosis. I mean, this is a rare manifestation of a disease we see every day, which is thyrotoxicosis. Interestingly, the first person who correctly responded to the New York Times is was an EMT who is studying to go to medical school. And he basically put in hyperthyroidism and paralysis and got this thing, Googled it, and got the answer and sent it in. So that's actually how you can do this now. References and publications and stuff, forget that. Anyway, so this is, again, one of those aha, if you've seen it, if you've read about it, this is classic for it. And as I'm thinking about it first diagnostically, I don't have to worry about the differential diagnosis of the paralysis. But I am thinking in the back of my mind about the differential diagnosis of his hyperthyroidism. Odds are that he's got Graves' disease, but it's not a slam dunk. He doesn't have ophthalmopathy. He doesn't have an autoimmune background. He doesn't have a big gland with a Brewy. So but statistically, that would probably be the most likely. He could have toxic nodules, toxic multinodular goiter. You said he was Chinese, but he hadn't recently emigrated.
No background, endemic. Born in California.
Goiter, anything like that. Okay. So you go down the usual differential diagnosis for his long-term or definitive evaluation and treatment of the usual Graves' disease, toxic nodule, toxic multinodular goiter. Could this be silent thyroiditis? I'm not hearing anything against it other than he's pretty thyrotoxic, but you can see free T4 is that high. And so as you're thinking about that, simultaneously you have to be thinking about how to treat his critical problem, which is the hypokalemia and the paralysis that it's causing and the EKG changes. So what brought this on? Well, it's a usually these people with thyrotoxic periodic paralysis are genetically predisposed to this, we think. And I don't know if that family history with the uncle, was it, who died?
Yeah, we couldn't get any more history out of that.
Who knows about that, yeah. But possible. And then the precipitating so this is due to abrupt shifts in potassium into the cells, often precipitated by exactly the sort of things that this guy had going on. He was exercising in the heat, and then he had this big carbohydrate meal, thereby causing the insulin secretion and the potassium to go into the cells. So he hasn't actually lost potassium out of his body. It's just all in his cells. And that's why you're worried about shifting them back out of the cells and rebound hyperkalemia and that sort of thing. So that's what's going on with him pathophysiologically. I don't know that I have a whole lot to add with the acute treatment. You obviously have to give them potassium, and you have to get the hyperadrenergic stimulation, the hyperthyroid stimulation under control. And then this does tend to resolve as the post-exercise, post-carbohydrate load, so on, starts to dissipate. So I pretty much would have done what you did, which was potassium loading and try and get his hyperthyroidism under control. Beta blockade, you could argue maybe that this is one of the few cases where you want to use PTU, at least acutely, rather than methimazole for the extra T4 to T3 conversion kick that you can get. And then once that all settles down, he needs the diagnostic workup and the definitive treatment.
Yeah, I don't know if I can add anything to that. I hope some of you went to Dr. Samuel's thyroiditis, meet the professor, or... So I want to ask you, is the high level of his free T4 mitigate against mitigated all against thyroiditis?
It's a bit high.
Yeah. So one of the things you have to be careful about is not overshooting with the potassium. You're giving beta blockers at the same time. Or you give a selective beta blocker. You want to make sure, because much of the hypokalemia is catechol-mediated, causing potassium to enter the cell. If you block that right away and give a lot of potassium right away, which happens in the ER, the patient goes to the ER, he gets potassium, a CT scan, of course, and Rocephin. And so, but you have to be very careful. They do it, you know. Your place too. Selenium. So yeah, you have to be careful. In terms of his uncle, he died of maybe a muscle problem. Well, I think it's unlikely because respiratory muscles are spared. Interestingly, it's a large muscle groups. Do we have time for a story? Okay. Once upon a time, before any of you were born, I was an endocrine fellow, and the first part of my fellowship was in the lab, and I'd go to clinic once a week, and there was a hematology fellow who was Japanese-American, and we used to play basketball. Believe it or not, it's true. but I was selective in whom I played with, and he wasn't much taller than me. And we were playing in the summer, and it was really hot. And at L.A. County, there was a basketball court in the back before the parking lot. And he was drinking lemonade and playing basketball and really vigorous. And I was this brilliant endocrine fellow. Well, later that night, he came in paralyzed. He had thyrotoxic hypokalemic periodic paralysis. And he'd been thyrotoxic all the time, of course, being a really sharp endocrine fellow. I had no idea he had hyperthyroidism because I was focusing on my jump shot. So, but it usually is Asian males. We will see in Los Angeles Latinas with it. They may be, their background may be Native American. As you know, Asians came across the Bering Strait, came down, many migrate in California, Central, South America, and many of the Latinos in Los Angeles, or in California, let's say probably Texas as well, may have some Asian background. We've seen it also, Mary, and you probably have in Caucasian, especially those of Russian descent, right next to China, people crawling under the wire and doing all kinds of things, I guess. So, but most of the time, it's an Asian male. Question? David, the question was, how much potassium, how much did you check? You said you gave enough to show you care, but not enough to make a difference.
That's exactly what we did, yeah.
You gave a little bit.
We gave a little bit. So actually, what we've done previously with patients similar to this, in the absence of any acute coronary issues, like this patient did have, in the absence of those, we often try and hold off on repleting potassium because these episodes tend to self-resolve, and treatment with beta blockers and hydration and then removing the carbohydrate load or waiting for the carbohydrate load to leave the body, they will get better on their own. We gave this patient 20 PO and then put him on a 10 or added 10 into the bag an hour and checked his potassium every hour. And within 2 hours, his potassium was up over 2 and his function was back almost completely, and we stopped the potassium in the bag and just gave him normal saline back. So he ended up getting about 40 milliequivalents.
This is the most of you, I hope, heard Dr. Cooper's talk on hyperthyroidism yesterday. This is the kind of patient I would not try to treat looking for a remission. I would get rid of this thing with radioiodine as soon as I could, because if he's on methimazole, and then he stops to see whether it goes into remission or not, and it gets thyrotoxic, same thing can happen again. So this is one of those areas where you really need to ablate. Question? The question, any utility measuring urinary electrolytes, measuring potassium? I don't think so. I think you need to rely on your clinical judgment. That's what it is. Yeah.
If you didn't know he was hyperthyroid, and you were wondering, wondering whether he had lost, you know, been vomiting or diarrhea or sweating in the heat. So, if you didn't know he was thyrotoxic and you're just working up hypokalemia, you could. But in here it wouldn't be necessary because you already knew he was thyrotoxic.
Sorry. I'm going to, yeah, thank you. Okay, so our next case is from Allison Myers from UT Southwestern.
Good afternoon. So this case is of Ms. N. She's a 64-year-old female with a past medical history, like a lot of our patients, which goes on and on, of atrial fibrillation, flutter, CAD, CHF, hypertension, dyslipidemia, GERD, gout, chronic back pain, polysubstance abuse, and bilateral cataracts, for which she both had both of them were operated upon. So she was recently seen by her nurse practitioner for routine care. At that time, her thyroid function tests were checked. Her nurse practitioner would like to start her on levothyroxine for hypothyroidism. So she pages the endocrinology fellow to discuss the dosing, and that's unfortunately a common place where we are. The fellow asks for the patient's TFT, so I'll give them to you, and I also have the reference ranges. So these were just checked a couple of days before. TSH is 5.42, and the range is 0.40 to 4.5. The free T4 is 3.6. The reference range is 0.8 to 1.8. And her free T3 was 2.0. And the reference range for that would be 2 to 4.4. Did you get that? I didn't hear you.
5.42, 3.6, 2.0.
Yeah. Okay. The fellow asked the nurse practitioner to repeat the labs again and hold off on prescribing any medication. The repeat labs were TSH 5.49, which wasn't much different. Free T4 was 3.1, and the free T3 was 9.1.
It was
what? 9.1.
And it was 2 to 10.4?
Yeah, it was anywhere from 2 to 4.4 in the past, but at the time before it had been 2. Mm-hmm.
Wait a minute. It was 2.0, and then it was...
You know what? I just realized. Yeah, you know what? That was a typo. Excuse me. That was what was in here is incorrect. I'm sorry. So it was 10.9, the original free T3.
The first time?
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah, this was a typo in here. They just put the reference. I'm sorry. It was 10.9.
Okay, so the 3T3 was 10.9.
Right. So the labs were pretty much unchanged. So at that point, the patient was started on methimazole 10 milligrams daily. So on further review of the chart, the patient had several TSH and free T4 documented since 2006. Ironically enough, this is around the time she was diagnosed with atrial fibrillation. The TSH ranged anywhere from 3.1 to 5.61, and her free T4 was anywhere from 2.6 to 2.7. The patient confirmed that she had never been treated in the past with levothyroxine, methimazole, or any ablative procedure. She also denies any family history of thyroid disease, adrenal disease, or pituitary disease, as far as she knows. Her current medications are for the many medical problems she has, including allopurinol, metoprolol, nitroprn, amlodipine, isosorbide, ranitidine, digoxin, warfarin, fluconazone, albuterol, hydrocodone, and amitriptyline. So she's finally seen... Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. So the first one was allopurinol. I can repeat it one more time.
You can repeat it.
Okay. So it's allopurinol, metoprolol, nitroprn, amlodipine, isosorbide, ranitidine, digoxin, warfarin, fluticasone, albuterol, hydrocodone, and amitriptyline. Yeah, if you want to interrupt me, go ahead. And then I can save the physical for later if you have questions on history.
I'm willing to start talking at any time, but basically what you have here, I mean, you have a chronically ill patient with
right.
a lot of diseases, comorbidities, and a lot of medications, and all of which can potentially interact with the hypothalamic pituitary thyroid axis. And then what you ideally would hope for in a case like this is that somebody thinks about abnormal thyroid function, checks a TSH, and it's normal, and you never hear about it. So that's not what happened here, obviously. And what she's got is not just a present set of thyroid function tests that don't make any sense, but almost identical thyroid function tests that don't match up with each other dating back quite a while. So she's got kind of a persistently elevated free T4. Is that an analog assay, or is any of that equilibrium dialysis?
As far as I know, it was just a routine.
Okay. So she's got
these were all ordered by her primary care doctor.
So she's got a persistently elevated free T4, a persistently elevated free T3, and then this. And so you would think, well, she's hyperthyroid, but her TSH isn't suppressed. So the problem we've got evolving here is T4 and T3 levels that don't match the TSH, and they either can't all be right, or she's got something really rare and bizarre. And so, and there's a differential for all that.
Right.
And so one of the key initial questions when you see this is her thyroid hormone levels are off the wall. I mean, they're sky high. Is she thyrotoxic? Does she look hyperthyroid? So the first thing we really need to know is a careful examination and your assessment of whether she is manifesting those elevated T4 and T3 levels clinically.
Right.
So what was the physical? Well, let me ask one question. Yeah. Well, no, because then it makes it easier for me. I just, you know, says what was the physical, then I'm going to hand it back to you.
Nice. And let's, nice.
But let me ask a question first.
Sure. I hope I have
history of atrial fibrillation.
Yes.
How far back does that go?
Coincidentally, around 2006, and that's when if you look in the chart around the time that her labs changed. And ironically enough, no one ever put her on medication.
Okay, because what we're trying to figure out here is she hyperthyroid?
Right.
Is there a disconnect? Well, there's obviously a disconnect, and you're trying to pin down what is the reason for the disconnect. Is it something goofy in the lab, which we're going to get to, or does she have something upstairs, which could be causing hyperthyroidism, atrial fibrillation?
And I think her past cocaine abuse, which ended around that time, might have also, unfortunately, caused people to overlook what was happening.
Right. So the physical?
Okay. So for us, this was actually pretty good. I was able to get her in the clinic about 2 months later. So most of what had been done was unfortunately over the phone. But her vitals were completely normal. Granted, she is on a lot of blood pressure medication, but her blood pressure was like 120s over about 70s or 80s. Her pulse was normal. It was about in the 80s or so. The rest of her vitals were fine. Physical exam, the only pertinent findings were the fact that she had a bilateral resting hand tremor and brisk reflexes. Her thyroid exam was completely normal, palpable, normal size, no nodules, no bruises appreciated. And in terms of like complaints, she did note that she had chronic angina and palpitations, but this was not acute. This was around the time of her diagnosis. And she also had complained about headache and blurred vision. Now, the thing is, when she had the cataract surgery, they assumed that that would have corrected her vision. And she said with glasses, her eyesight was somewhat better. But when she was being worked up for her eye complaints previously, no one had ever scanned her head.
Was there a description in the eye by the ophthalmologist of what her discs look like? What we're after here is, were they pale? Did she have a hemianopsia?
I didn't see any mention of that, unfortunately. There wasn't in the chart. Because unfortunately, our record, the eye notes, just started going into our Epic system this year, so it wasn't in the chart.
Yeah. Okay.
But no proptosis or anything.
Yeah, so we're really pushing you on whether she is clinically hyperthyroid, but kind of in your defense, admittedly, I mean, she's 64 years old. She's got multiple comorbidities and is on multiple medications, some of which will directly block thyroid hormone effects. And there is this apathetic hyperthyroidism of the elderly. I mean, she's not that elderly, but I think physiologically, I'm ignoring him, you'll notice. Physiologically, she's probably older than 64, and you're all aware of this apathetic hyperthyroidism in the elderly, which is real. Mm-hmm. They tend to manifest less of the hyperadrenergic symptoms. If she were 30 years old and with these kind of thyroid hormone levels and not with any of these comorbidities on any of these kind of medications, you would be highly suspicious that these are spurious. But the accuracy of your physical examination is limited because of the kind of patient she has. So after you've told me this physical exam, I still don't know whether I want to come down on the side of these are real thyroid hormone levels, and the TSH is also real. The TSH, I mean, TSH assays are usually very reliable. Less tends to go wrong with them than with the free T4 and free T3 assays. So I'm still not sure whether I'm coming down on the side of these are real and TSH driven, which has its own list of possibilities, or these are some sort of, this is artifactual, and if anything, she might have a little bit of mild subclinical hypothyroidism, and it's completely the wrong thing to start her on methimazole. Mm-hmm. So there are a number of things you can start to do other than the physical exam, since you're limited to start to work that out. Mm-hmm. You can get artifactual elevations in the thyroid hormone levels due to these analog assays.
Right,
the free T3 is also elevated, different assay, but kind of a squirrely assay, frankly. So you can look for free T4 by equilibrium dialysis, for example. That'll take a while to send off. We've had a number of cases where there are interfering substances, including medications,
right,
on that assay, especially the analog assays. And when you send it to Quest Diagnostics for an equilibrium dialysis, lo and behold, it comes back normal, and you get to get that out of the chart. I don't know if you did that. No. Okay. So that would be one of the first things I might do, as you're probably simultaneously working her up to see whether she's got TSH-driven hyperthyroidism, which is a distinct possibility here.
Right.
I don't have too much to add, Mary. Speaking of repeating the free T4 in another assay, again, it's hard to know if she's hyperthyroid because she's on beta blockers as well and all kinds of stuff and could have apathetic hyperthyroidism, but also would be to send the TSH off to another lab to see whether, and I'm sure this is in your differential, whether she has a goofy TSH, which we'll get into. Now, do you know, because we can eliminate something way out, do you know whether or not she ever had thyroid function tests before the abnormal levels in 2006?
Yeah, she had a TSH, which was just on the cusp of our reference range at the high end of normal. That's the earliest when we had.
And a T4 at the same time?
Of course not, just a TSH.
It's a TSH, because what we're trying to do
is,
it's always in the differential, she's 64, just so we can dismiss thyroid hormone resistance. I mean, that's also in the differential here.
And that's why I asked for her family history.
Yeah, but highly unlikely, but, because at some point she may have had thyroid tests, and if they were normal, then you can obviously get rid of that, and no family history,
right,
which is important as well. So the differential right now is relatively narrow. You're pointing to something. You're giving it away, saying that she had blurry vision. But before going down that route.
But she thought this cataract surgery had fixed it, but it really didn't.
Well, maybe she didn't have a good operation, right? So, yeah. She doesn't work in a lab with little mice, does she?
She's unemployed.
Yeah. So, be nice to just do a TSH somewhere else before doing an MRI to make sure that she doesn't have heterophilic antibodies. It happens. I've had cases of hyperthyroidism with TSH elevation. Dr. Samuels has as well.
Okay, well, we have another set of TFTs, and they were done in another lab.
Oh, we do. Okay.
Well, when she came back to see us, we had a TSH of 7.8. A free T4 of 2.5 and a free T3 of 7.8. And again, she had been taking methimazole at that point for a couple of months.
Okay, so you've got confirmation from a different TSH assay that TSH is reliably elevated. Mm-hmm. Your free T4 and T3 remain elevated, although, again, they're analog assays. But the fact that both are elevated rather than just one of them, if I see an isolated free T4 that's out of whack, my first thought is it's the analog assay, but you've got two.
Mm-hmm.
I would start leaning more towards this is true TSH-mediated hyperthyroidism, and as Peter implied, the main differential of that is central hyperthyroidism from a pituitary tumor versus you'd have to have a resistance to thyroid hormone, which, as he mentioned, should be genetic. So the way you can work that up is with an alpha subunit, because many of these tumors co-secrete alpha subunit. Mm-hmm. But what you really need is an MRI of her pituitary. The headaches, the blurred vision are worrisome. You didn't tell us on physical exam whether she's got bitemporal hemianopsia, but most of these tumors are fairly good sized when they are diagnosed. They're usually macroadenomas, although you'd like to diagnose them before that. Many of them co-secrete, as I mentioned, alpha right. subunit. Many of them also co-secrete growth hormone. Mm-hmm. There's a whole workup you do once right. you have identified that mass lesion. So I'd be MRIing her head.
Would you like to know her pituitary function test?
Yeah, while you're MRIing her head, you can do a pituitary test too. So yeah, so the workup, once you start mm-hmm. thinking that this is central and it's probably due to a pituitary tumor, then pituitary disease is complicated. Thyroid disease is not. That's my simplistic differential, because thyroid has, it's like one hormone, and TSH, versus lots of hormones, each one of which has their own axis. So whenever I see a patient with suspected pituitary disease, in my simplistic initial fashion, I walk into the clinic, into the office, into the room, and I say, I have to have some answers, or at least investigate three things. Are there mass effects? Headache, blurred vision, by history, bitemporal hemianopsia, extraocular movement dysfunction if it's going out laterally into the cavernous sinus. And so I'm looking for mass effects. I'm looking for hypersecretion. In this case, we've already got labs that suggest centrally mediated hyperthyroidism, but I'm also going to look for acromegaly because these often co-secrete growth hormone. Hyperprolactinemia wouldn't manifest itself in a 64-year-old, so mm-hmm. on and so on. And then I'm looking for hypopituitarism. So while I'm asking her the thyroid questions, I'm also asking her questions about adrenal insufficiency. Again, hypogonadism, not in a 64-year-old woman. Right. So I do. It's three categories: mass effects, hypopit, and hypersecretion. So yeah, we can talk about, or you can tell us whether she's got symptoms or signs of adrenal insufficiency, mm-hmm. and you can show us inappropriately low FSHs and LHs and high prolactins mm-hmm. and all that. But you have to, even if none of those other things come back abnormal at this point, you have to MRI her head mm-hmm. because she's got what we think is centrally mediated right. hyperthyroidism.
Yeah, it's just it takes a while for us to get MRIs, sorry. So we actually got our labs first, yeah.
So thyroid is uncomplicated. You did say it's easy. You said it's easy, Mary. I feel like a 40-year career now has been wasted.
Instead of becoming a neuroendocrinologist, you became a thyroid.
Actually, I also run our pituitary service, medical service, and we've had our ninth case of pituitary TSH secreting adenomas. There may be about 0.5% of all tumors, so we've had very few. We've had over 1,000 adenomas operating at University Hospital, or about 1,200, and we just had our ninth TSH adenoma. But every one of them, and they're macroadenomas. Mm-hmm. All ours were macro, but parenthetically, Mary, none of them had any ACTH deficiency, didn't have hypopit. Mm-hmm. The easiest way to know if a patient's hypopit and avoid a lot of tests, well, Mary talks about growth hormone. That's another issue, hypersecretion. Mm-hmm. Just do an FSH. She's 64.
Right.
If the FSH is elevated, as it would be in a postmenopausal woman, the rest of the stuff is going to be normal.
Right.
So what was her FSH?
What you would expect for a menstruating woman, 7.8.
Seven, so? It's low. So she has gonadotropin deficiency.
And, of course, because she was postmenopausal, it was hard
yeah.
to figure out
so
until we got labs to know.
Drugs. I mean, so opioids can so the other thing
right.
is that she's on a slew of drugs and she has a history of drug abuse, and opioids can lead to central suppression mm-hmm. of gonadotropins and ACTH and all that. But that would be kind of a red herring in this case, I think. That's
right.
that's a very inappropriate FSH for her age,
right.
Assuming she's not on lots of estrogen replacement or
no,
something.
No, she's
like
not
that.
On any HRT.
And
she
even,
never took
and
it.
Even then, it doesn't usually come down that low. So that's now you're really starting to worry about her pituitary gland. So
would you like to hear the rest of her pituitary labs?
No, I want to know her MRI. No, I'm kidding. Go ahead.
I can jump to the MRI.
No, give us the rest of the pituitary labs and then her MRI.
Okay. So her ACTH was low normal. It was 15. Our range is 6 to 58. Cortisol was 6.6, and these were done around 8 a.m. IGF-1 was also low. It was 43. The range is 72 to 207. Her prolactin was 7. The range is 4.8 to 23.3. We did LH and FSH. And again, they were normal for somebody who was still menstruating, but they were low for someone who's postmenopausal. Her LH was 5.5, FSH 7.8. And her alpha subunit came back also elevated at 5.5. For our lab reference range in a postmenopausal woman, it should be less than 1.8.
An alpha subunit actually could be a little bit elevated in a postmenopausal woman, provided her FSH is elevated. Mm-hmm. But her FSH is not. So I think we have to consider this the real deal. And her
ratio is about 1.
Pardon me?
And the ratio, the alpha subunit to TSH was about 1.
Yeah. So she has a TSH-secreting pituitary adenoma. And so you want her MRI?
Okay. So the MRI showed a right-sided cellar mass, 17 millimeters by 16 millimeters by 12 millimeters, without invasion of the cavernous sinus, internal carotid arteries, or impingement on the optic chiasm.
So she was free of any impingement on the chiasm.
Yes, luckily.
So her vision
eye, right.
has
That's
nothing
why her
to do
eye exam was okay.
Yeah, her vision is
so
nothing
it was
to do
it was
with
consistent
this.
With her physical exam.
Okay.
Yeah. So
excellent case. Now
she's
treatment?
Going to the OR Tuesday.
Yeah. So this is a classic size and presentation of a TSH secreting tumor in that she's had normal to mildly elevated TSH levels. The variation in TSH levels in TSH secreting tumors is quite broad, and you can have markedly elevated levels, but you can have normal to mildly elevated levels, and it turns out that the bioactivity may be enhanced in these in terms of the glycosylation of the TSH secreted from some of these tumors. But we've seen TSH secreting tumors with completely normal TSH levels. The key, obviously, here is that they're not suppressed, which they should be if the free T4 and T3 were coming from autonomous thyroid function. Mm-hmm. And they tend to have quite high alpha subunit levels, which as you showed high ratios. They this one is not co-secreting anything other than alpha free alpha subunit. Mm-hmm. A fair number of them co-secrete prolactin or growth hormone, and they present with these large tumors. She's lucky in that it's not affecting the optic chiasm or the extraocular muscles. The treatment is surgical, if they're good surgical candidates at all, and it doesn't sound like she's a horrible surgical candidate. I mean, she does have coronary disease, but you certainly don't want her walking around being thyrotoxic. You could, so surgery would be indicated. You might want to control her hyperthyroidism going into surgery, so you would give her methimazole.
Right. You can also use octreotide, which she's not a fan of needles, and since we got her free T4 down, we said, okay, we'll just leave her on
methimazole. Okay, and you got that down just with methimazole?
Yeah, so we had that discussion. Yeah.
Right, okay. And so the these tumors tend to have somatostatin receptors, and they respond often very nicely to somatostatin, which is a hypothalamic inhibitory hormone for growth hormone, but it's also a normal hypothalamic or physiologic hypothalamic inhibitory factor for TSH. And if I infused somatostatin into any of you, your TSH levels would go way down. So it's a part of the hypothalamic pituitary thyroid feedback loop. It's an inhibitory factor like dopamine is for TSH. And these patients often respond very nicely if you haven't cured them surgically with to somatostatin or long-acting somatostatin octreotide analogs in the long run. So that's a nice adjuvant medical therapy. But unless you were a horrible surgical candidate, primary surgery followed, if necessary, by octreotide. When I was a fellow, which was only slightly later than when you were a fellow, I think, and we used to also give external beam radiation to all of these patients as well as all of our other macroadenomas, and that has fallen out of favor, and I think rightly so, because it takes a long time to work. It often doesn't work really well, and we just weren't aware of the side effects, the long-term side effects like we are now. So I would not treat her with radiation therapy unless she had an aggressive recurrent tumor, and that's really rare. So surgery, medical control of the hyperthyroidism to get her into surgery and out of surgery safely, debulking from an experienced neurosurgeon transsphenoidally, you know, don't go craniotomy on this woman, and then octreotide.
Yeah. We've had about 4 cases the past couple of years. Yeah. Wow, this is my second one. Yeah. Yeah. Just randomly they end up with us. Thanks.
Thank you.
The next case is from Ari Wassner from Boston Children's.
So, hi everybody. So for all of you pediatric fellows out there who've been feeling a little out of your depth maybe, this should be something maybe a little bit more familiar to you guys. Do you mind if I move this just so we can see each other?
You know, we don't do kids, so.
This does happen in adults too, so it's not.
I hate kids. I hate kids.
So, okay, so this was a baby who, I'm going to tell you. Uh-huh. Oh, nice. All right. So this baby initially presented at 6 weeks old. This was a 6-week-old boy who just showed up at his pediatrician's office for a regular well-child check at 6 weeks. And the pediatrician, in examining the baby, auscultated a new cardiac murmur. And so cardiac murmurs in babies, if they're significant, get pretty quick workup just to make sure there's no congenital cardiac anomaly. So they quickly referred this baby to a cardiologist who did an echocardiogram. And as they were looking at this baby's heart, the baby had a small patent foramen ovale, which is a pretty common benign variant. They also happened to, I guess, put the probe on the abdomen, and they thought that the liver looked a bit enlarged. And so they looked a little bit further, and they saw some unusual abnormal hypoechoic lesions in the liver. So they quickly said, this is not the heart. You need to get some directed abdominal imaging, which the baby had shortly thereafter. And basically they found that almost the entire liver was occupied by these large hypoechoic lesions. Related to that, the cardiologist was quite well-informed and was aware of the possible related issue and sent thyroid function tests. And so, and we'll get to the explanation in a bit, but basically the baby had a TSH of 74, they didn't do any measure of T4 at the time, and the cardiologist said, hey, this kid is hypothyroid, started the baby on 37.5 micrograms of levothyroxine, which is a pretty standard dose for a baby at this age. I should also say, for those of you who don't do pediatrics, if you went to Dr. Denauer's talk the other day, we don't wait to start kids on treatment until we figure out the cause. Babies get started on levothyroxine as soon as we find out they're hypothyroid because we worry about their brain development, and we figure out the etiology later.
So can I interrupt?
Please.
Right?
Correct. Yeah, so he had a normal – that's a good point.
So in 6 weeks, is thyroid function. I don't know what the screen is, but his thyroid function.
Correct. Yeah, so he had a normal newborn screen. So that was what happened. So 37.5 micrograms a day is about 8 micrograms per kilo. So you can compare that to a normal adult replacement would be, 1¾ or 2 micrograms per kilo. So babies get a lot more than adults anyway. So this baby was, because of these lesions, which they thought looked like vascular anomalies, was sent to our center, which has a vascular anomalies clinic, and was examined there. And so I'll tell you what they elicited there and what we elicited subsequently in terms of history. The baby had basically the product of a normal pregnancy. There were no complications. Birth was fine. Newborn screen, as noted, was normal. And the baby had been healthy pretty much up until that point. Though they said maybe the last 2 weeks or so he'd been a little bit more fussy, a little bit less not eating quite as well, but otherwise had been fine. They didn't suspect any abnormalities. He wasn't taking any medications other than the levothyroxine he had just been started on. He was the first baby of two parents who lived together. There was no family history of thyroid disease. Mom did not have any history of thyroid disease or specifically autoimmune thyroid disease. And that was pretty much the history. Is there anything else you'd want to know about the history?
I'd like to know why you're doing this.
Uh-huh.
To you and me, Mary. I mentioned I can't stand kids. And right when we're talking, I have a phone call from my daughter. She just called. Probably wants more money. But there's nothing else. I think we know what the diagnosis is, and it's extraordinarily rare disorder that a pediatrician can go through his or her career without ever seeing such a case.
True.
Right?
True.
Okay. Who has the next case? Pardon me? Do you want us to give you the diagnosis? I don't know what else to do. I mean, the patients.
Do you know any of the blood tests?
Oh, any blood tests for this? I don't. You've had a T. What was the T4?
So they had, at this point, they had not done any T4.
Oh,
they had
I'm sorry.
TSH.
Go ahead. So, all right. What are the thyroid?
So I'll tell you what happened. So basically, this baby went to a vascular anomalies clinic, and they called us and said, what should we do? And so we asked them to send thyroid function tests, including a TSH, which at that point went up to 94, so had already been started on a normal dose of thyroid hormone, but TSH had increased in the about.
But what was the T4?
And the T4 at that time, the free T4 was 1.3, which is sort of low normal for age.
Yeah.
And the T3 was a little bit low at 91. So the normal lower limit of normal for age is about 100. So the T3 was a little low.
Yeah.
T4.
Well, kiddies will really amp up TSH. Young people can have much higher TSHs than other people, adults. And
that's what we call this.
You mind, Mary? First of all, you said what I do is easy. Second of all, you said that last patient was elderly. So this is not going too well. But you can have it. Squelched again. Squelched again. Well put. So, I mean, a T4 just below normal. A little kid can have a TSH of 70. You can have youngsters. You can have a child or a teenager who has a T4 that's only mildly elevated. TSH can be in the few hundreds. So the kid has hypothyroidism. The question is, why does he have it? I don't know of any other test to do. I think this child, this infant, has a very, very, very rare disorder. Probably has a hemangioblastoma and what's called consumptive hypothyroidism. Is that the diagnosis?
Yes, that is the diagnosis. So I'll tell you, the thing I might point out is, so at this point his T4 was normal. His T3 was actually a little bit low, which is not, as so you guys I'm sure know, that in hypothyroidism, typically the T3 is defended.
Right.
T3 is the last thing to drop. And in this particular condition, that's often...
Well, there's an impairment of a deaminase enzyme in this disorder.
Yeah, so
which
this,
you're going to describe.
So I'm happy,
right?
I'm happy to talk more about the clinical presentation, or I can talk a little bit more about the pathophysiology, whatever people
Please,
would like.
Go ahead.
So, so this baby actually presented. So we got these results, and obviously he was referred to CSN clinic. And basically the night before he was supposed to come and see us, he got admitted to the ICU because he developed apnea, which is actually not an uncommon presentation for these babies. The thought is that maybe his liver was just so big that he couldn't move his diaphragms. But these babies tend to present often with apnea. So he ended up in the ICU, and that was when we actually first physically saw him. At the time, he was intubated, and so the exam was a little bit limited, but things that were particularly notable, he did not have a large fontanelle, which you often see with congenital hypothyroidism. The fellow who initially saw him actually thought that they could palpate a fullness in his neck that might be a thyroid. They weren't totally sure, but typically, in infants, you should not be able to palpate a thyroid. Any palpable thyroid gland in an infant is a goiter. And so they thought maybe he had a palpable thyroid. Other than that, his exam was mostly notable just for a just diffusely enlarged liver all the way down to the pelvic brim. And it was all, by imaging, composed of these large hemangiomas. And I'll tell you, the only other lab value that I'll throw in, which is not typically sent, but which we sent at the time, was a reverse T3, which was above the limit of the assay. And so that, even without that, I think the diagnosis was pretty clear. But as Dr. Singer mentioned, this baby had consumptive hypothyroidism. So this is a condition that's seen in in infants, it's hemangiomas. It has been reported in adults. In fact, Dr. Fish was involved in a case that was reported in an adult.
I saw the first adult patient.
Yeah.
And
so it's published in JCNM in 2002, but this is only reported. So this, as a clinical entity, was only reported for the first time in 2000 in a case report. And there have subsequently been a number of infants, and at least one adult that's been published, and I think there have been a couple of others. Bottom line is these hemangiomas, which live in the liver, produce large amounts of type 3 deiodinase, which is the inactivating deiodinase. It inactivates T4 to reverse T3, it inactivates T3 to T2, and it preferentially inactivates T3. T3 is the preferred substrate, which is one of the reasons that T3 goes down before T4 does, which is the opposite of what you typically see. So that's what this baby had. And the other thing you should note is that he got a normal replacement dose of levothyroxine, and his TSH continued to rise because he basically was just eating up all of his thyroid hormone, and his thyroid was cranking it out, and he was getting consumed. So the treatment for the thyroid piece of this, at least, was essentially just to give him enormous doses of thyroid hormone. So he started on initially an infusion of T3, which didn't really work very well. He ended up getting IV T4 while he was intubated. And his doses escalated to about 100 micrograms twice a day of T4, and he was about 4.5 kilos. So that comes out to about 40 some mics per kilo per day. And then the usual approach that I was taught for this patient was essentially to give T4 until the free T4 was somewhat above the upper limit of normal. And if TSH doesn't normalize, to add T3 because T3 is being preferentially consumed. So this baby ended up on 100 mics twice a day of levothyroxine plus 20 micrograms twice a day of leothyronine. And that finally was enough to bring the TSH down to the normal range for age. The other thing is that obviously as these cholangiomas involute, the D3 goes down, they're not consuming as much, and they can very quickly become hyperthyrotoxic as the hemangiomas involute, which they do. The natural history of these is that they tend to grow over the first year or so, and then they begin to involute, and they go away spontaneously in kids. Not necessarily the case in adults. And I think the patient you reported had to have a liver transplant. It may be a slightly different tumor in adults, but in kids, these things go away. They can happen on the skin. They're very common in the skin. Cutaneous hemangiomas in babies happen all the time, but they're not large enough to cause consumptive hypothyroidism. In any case, we followed this baby for several months.
Was he able to get all that thyroid hormone orally eventually when he was not intubated?
Yeah, so he did. He ended up switching over to he got levothyroxine 100 microgram tablets twice a day. And then he got leothyronine. Initially, I think he got that twice a day. And then we sort of backed off slowly over the course of the next couple of weeks. Initially, he was getting daily TFTs in the hospital. He was getting them every 2 or 3 days for the first couple of weeks. And now he's been backed off. Even now, about 7 months later, he gets TFTs about every 3 or 4 weeks. And the concern really is that as this thing shrinks, he's still at this moment on 50 micrograms twice a day of levothyroxine, which is a huge dose for a baby.
But he's growing and his doses are coming down.
Correct. So his body size is increasing and his hemangiomas are now shrinking. These things are treated with propranolol and glucocorticoids. There are other treatments if they don't respond. But
are you ever pushed for more active intervention surgically, or is that a bad idea?
They really, really will do everything humanly possible not to operate in babies because they resolve spontaneously. Uh-huh. If you can get them through. You know, the hypothyroidism is the rare part. These are often not big enough to cause hypothyroidism, and they basically will wait. So I believe in Europe they actually will not even necessarily treat them with steroids. They'll just essentially feed with an NJ tube and just let them go, make sure they keep growing, and they eventually will go away. Not all babies do well. The first baby with this that was reported actually died. And I don't remember what the cause was exactly, but got septic in the ICU and so forth. But this baby did very well. Hemangiomas are shrinking, and dose of levothyroxine is coming down. It can take quite a long time. I think Andy Bauer reported a case not too long ago that took well over a year to come off levothyroxine. But this baby is growing well and doing great. So it's just something that it's, again, as you say, extremely rare, but definitely has been reported in at least a couple of adults. So you may see it at some point. Yeah, so they have looked at cutaneous hemangiomas, and they do have expression of D3. So the presumption is that they're just not large enough. And it's not all hemangiomas that do it, I don't think, but certainly there's a subset that do, and that includes some that are cutaneous. Most of the ones that have been reported with this degree of hypothyroidism are in the liver. So, you know, it's a fair point. I think he was on such big doses that we weren't so much worried about the intricacies of, like, you know, how much conversion. The bottom line is we just try to get his TSH in the normal range for his age. It's a fair point. Also, propranolol is a very new treatment for this. It's only been reported in, like, one center, and this is the first patient actually we've treated with propranolol. So it seems to be working fine, but it's pretty new.
I have a question. You said this infant had a PFO.
Yeah.
Is there a higher prevalence with these hemangiomas and other abnormalities? Do you know?
You mean it's sort of like congenital abnormalities?
Yes.
I don't believe so. You know, PFOs are pretty common in babies, so I don't know of any association. But this is a rare thing, and I don't know if I could tell you for sure. Other infants, not this one, but the first infant that was reported with this, if any of you were at the fellows conference, I can't remember who. I think it was Dr. Haugen who presented the patient with heart failure who was just severely hypothyroid. So the initial baby who presented also had heart failure because of his consumptive hypothyroidism, and then it improved with replacement. So it can be very severe.
I have a question about the steroids that you use. Yeah. Do you think that the steroids effect on the TSH compromised your ability to use T4, and that's why you had to use the T3?
Yeah, it's a fair point. I think it's one of those things that it may have, and we don't have much choice because that has been the traditional treatment, has been corticosteroids. It's true that it certainly can. It could suppress his TSH. In this case, our problem was that his TSH was high most of the time, so I wasn't worried as much about, you know, artificial decreasing of his TSH. But anyway, I think we got to move on. But
so the next case is from Scott Thomas. He didn't tell me where he's from, so I don't know.
I'm also from University of Southern California.
Oh, that's why you didn't tell me.
So this is a 35-year-old Guatemalan female with a known history of hyperthyroidism who presented to our ER at LA County with a complaint of bilateral lower extremity edema over the past 4 months, with recent worsening and the development of pain when ambulating. Other symptoms she complained of included occasional palpitations, fatigue, decreased exercise tolerance, hair loss, increased frequency of stools, and an unintentional 20-pound weight loss over the past 2 years. She denied any heat intolerance, anxiety, tremor, chest pain, shortness of breath, orthopnea, PND, and stated that she was using one pillow to sleep at night, which was her baseline. So her past medical history is significant for a known history of hyperthyroidism for 3 years, irregular menses for 2 years, stating that her periods were infrequent and marked by light bleeding. She had a past surgical history of bilateral tubal ligation. She knew that she was taking some sort of thyroid medication, but didn't know the exact dose and didn't know the name, and she didn't bring her bottle with her. She didn't know of any family history of thyroid disease. Was born in Guatemala. She moved to L.A. 15 years prior to presenting to our ER, and she lived with her 14-year-old boy and 6-year-old girl. So on exam, her temperature was 98 degrees Fahrenheit, blood pressure 102 over 60, heart rate 121, respiratory rate was 18. She was 5'5", weighed 110 pounds, 50 kilos, the BMI of almost 19. She was alert and appropriate during the exam. She was conversive. She was eating some cereal. She was noted to have some temporal wasting and cachexia, very thin. She had exothalmos, bilateral chemosis, and scleral icterus. Her thyroid was diffusely enlarged to about 3 times normal with an audible bruit. Her lungs were clear, but she was tachycardic with an irregular rhythm. Her abdomen was soft. There was no organomegaly noted, thin extremities, 3-plus pedine edema, smooth, warm skin, and a fine tremor. So some notable labs. She had an undetectable TSH. Her free T4 was above measurable in our lab, greater than 7.77 nanograms per dil. Her creatinine was 0.3. She had an alkaline phosphatase of 306. In our lab, the upper limit of normal is 100. An albumin of 2.7. Transaminase is slightly elevated with an AST of 88, an ALT of 37, a total bilirubin of 5, a direct bilirubin of 3.6. She had some PT prolongation at 18 seconds and an elevated INR of 1.47, with the upper limit of normal being 1.14. She had a white count of 4.9, 57% neutrophils, 23% lymphs, hemoglobin of 10.7, and platelets of 144. Sure, white count of 4.9, hemoglobin of 10.7, the crit of 31.7 and platelets of 144,000, and 57% neutrophils, 23% lymphocytes. EKG showed that she was in AFib with RVR. Chest X-ray showed some cardiomegaly and pulmonary vascular congestion. She was 98 degrees.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. She had pitting edema up to above her knees.
Pitting.
Okay, well, I'll start. So this is a 35-year-old woman with, it sounds like, a fairly established history of hyperthyroidism for at least 3 years, who is both clinically and biochemically pretty hyperthyroid right now. I mean, I don't think there's any question that she is actively and pretty markedly hyperthyroid. The in addition, and her free T4 is higher than the assay range. Again, you can have funny free T4 levels, and you, especially with autoimmune disease, you can get antibodies, but I think we can believe that. And so she's actually got a number of complications, possible complications of the hyperthyroidism, as well as I worry about some possible complications of the medication that we don't know what she's on. PTU or methimazole are the most likely. So she, in addition to the hyperadrenergic hyperthyroid findings, you're worried about her cardiac function because she could be in congestive heart failure. Certainly her physical examination is consistent with that, not diagnostic but consistent. And she's also in rapid atrial fibrillation, which could be contributing, obviously, to poor ventricular filling and heart failure as well. So she's got a lot of cardiac manifestations or side effects, which are quite dangerous in terms of her hyperthyroidism. And so you wonder about whether she's been compliant, how much medication she was on, probably non-compliant, I would guess. But this is a thyrotoxic emergency. She's also got elevated liver function tests, which are you can see in thyrotoxicosis. But if she were on PTU, especially, you'd worry about hepatotoxicity. She's got an increased INR. I was hoping her her white count wasn't also down. So I think that this the unifying diagnosis here is severe untreated thyrotoxicosis. I would also worry about medication side effects. You start to wonder about the diagnosis of thyroid storm in a case like this. She is not febrile. She does not have altered mental status, so you can't really put her squarely into that bin. But this is dangerous, acute, severe hyperthyroidism. She needs hospitalization. She needs stabilization and treatment pretty quickly. In terms of the differential diagnosis of hyperthyroidism, which usually we have more of a luxury of thinking about that because they're not acutely ill, this is almost certainly Graves' disease. She's you mentioned the goiter with the Brewy, the exophthalmos, the three-year history. She's a young woman. So she's got Graves' disease. You don't have to worry about that. What you need to do is get her cardiac status worked up. So you probably want to get an echo. You need to get her AFib under control, and you need to get her hyperthyroidism under control as quickly as possible. So she probably needs an ICU admission with all of those things. What am I forgetting, Peter?
Nothing.
Okay.
Okay. Yes. So in the ER, she was started on an Esmolol drip and given metoprolol 25 milligrams PO times 1 and methimazole 10 milligrams PO times 1. She was admitted to the medical ICU and on the advice of the endocrine service changed to a propranolol drip. Overnight, because of volume overload, she was given Lasix 20 milligrams IV twice. Also overnight, her mental status deteriorated and she spiked a fever to 103 degrees Fahrenheit. We'd seen her in the ER. We were kind of unaware of some of the overnight management, but we were called in the morning, and we were told about the change in mental status and the fever. She was started on PTU 100 milligrams, POTID, Decadron 4 milligrams, that should be IV, Q 6 hours, and supersaturated potassium iodide 10 drips, POQ 8 hours. In the morning, her tachyarrhythmia continued. She was still running very fast, 100 teens, 120s, but her blood pressure was low with a MAP in the low to mid-70s. Too low to continue the propranolol drip. So we talked about it, and we stopped the propranolol drip and went ahead and started her on amiodarone because at that point in time she'd been receiving antithyroid drug therapy. Her rhythm then transitioned from atrial fibrillation to atrial flutter, and apparently the cardiology service was called, and cardioversion was attempted. Shortly after cardioversion, she went into pulseless electrical activity, requiring ACLS and intubation. They needed to use 4 pressors to maintain her blood pressure. And over the next few days, her creatinine increased to 1.21 from the initial creatinine of 0.3. Her total bilirubin increased to 11.3, AST to 3,800, ALT to 1,800. Fibrinogen went down to 173. Her D-dimer was beyond the measurable upper limit of our assay. PT 48.7 and INR 5.27. Yeah, she was a sick lady.
Well, this is exactly what Dr. Samuels was worried about. You said, Mary, that it's an emergency, needs to be admitted, patient needs to be admitted. She's not in storm, but it's a slippery slope. And she seems to have now developed thyroid storm, which, as you know, is characterized by mental status changes, fever, and very significant hyperthyroidism, thyrotoxicosis. So one wonders whether or not this was induced. She didn't have this before getting. One of the things you need to be really careful about is giving diuretics. And these patients are basically AV shunts. If you're hyperthyroid, you generally don't have a fever because you're perfectly vasodilated. You're getting rid of body heat. If you're hypothyroid, mixedematous, your core temperature will be lower. But if you're hyperthyroid, your core temperature is not higher, maybe a trace, but really not higher because now instead of having a blood volume of 5 liters, maybe it's 6.5, let's just say. You're vasodilated. Now she's, I'm assuming was vasodilated. She got Lasix, furosemide, and became hypotensive. I'm just hypothesizing, unless she had sepsis. Became hypotensive and now went into storm. And then got the usual storm treatment, right?
Yes.
Which you're going to describe or?
Describe
with
PTU
giving PTU in someone with a bilirubin of this and that and the other and LFTs, but it's what you do. So what happened? Or Mary, do you have any additional?
The sickest patient I ever took care of was not with hyperthyroidism was a little bit different than this, but he was a young man who had been given PTU for Graves' disease and went into fulminant liver failure from PTU hepatotoxicity and then got septic and was in the ICU for months and was thyrotoxic because he was off his PTU, and he didn't get this bad in terms of he had a young, healthy heart. He managed but he was pretty thyrotoxic. And I didn't want to start his PTU because of his liver damage. And this woman probably has shock liver now because her LFTs have gone through the roof. And so you're really worried about the PTU. On the other hand, if you don't treat their hyperthyroidism, they're going to die from this. And you're kind of between a rock and a hard place. And what we ended up doing in our patient is we put him on methimazole instead because methimazole tends to lead to cholestatic, not hepatocellular damage. And before I did that, I called up Dave Cooper because I wasn't willing to do this on my own without tapping into his extensive experience. And he said, yeah, go ahead and do that. So you are kind of between a rock and a hard place here because she is extremely thyrotoxic, which is the underlying driving force with all this, but she's got tachyarrhythmias that you're trying to get under control with amiodarone. She's got poor cardiac function. She could be septic. You have to work them up for that. There are often precipitating causes of thyroid storm. So when somebody spikes a fever like that, I'm sure she got blood cultures and cultures and of various bodily fluids and antibiotics. And she's got shock liver, and so she's in tremendous trouble. And you have to get the hyperthyroidism under control. So I might put, I don't know if you stopped the PTU because of your worry about the liver or whether you kind of soldiered through with that, but I would consider now that you've got potassium iodine on board, steroids perhaps, to other ways to block the T4 to T3 conversion, which is the real reason to use PTU instead of methimazole and thyroid storm. I'd consider putting her on high-dose methimazole rather than PTU. This tremendously urgent, emergent treatment for thyrotoxicosis in this setting is you have to block everything you can, and, you know, D do they need emergency surgery? Incredibly high mortality rates from surgery, but those are the kind of discussions you have. So I dexamethasone, potassium iodine, you've already got her on those. Methimazole, cardiac stabilization, you know, she's a multi-organ failure now, and her mortality rate is going to be really high, unfortunately.
We did continue the PTU. Her bilirubin went up. It peaked, I think, at 21.
So you didn't want to use you were worried about methimazole in that case because of...
Well, I think we were just, more than anything, trying not to change things.
Trying
too much.
To get everything on board, okay.
But her heart disease was very... The PTU? NG, at that point, she had an NG tube.
She was absorbing, as far as you know?
As far as we know, okay. Yeah. I mean, she wasn't having hypernefication or a lot of...
Because you can give it rectally if you need to, if they're not... Yeah, so you're absolutely right. This is you can get elevated liver function tests in uncomplicated hyperthyroidism, and then you can get really elevated liver function tests in thyrotoxicosis. And I wouldn't have been thinking about that except that she's been on something for the last 3 years, and she came in already with elevated liver function tests. And so I was trying to think about, could this be a medication side effect? But this is almost certainly her hyperthyroidism plus shock liver. You know, continuing the PTU was a judgment call and completely appropriate. I might have used the methimazole instead just in case, but you're right. I mean, this is almost certainly hyperthyroidism plus perhaps now shock liver, given that she had that event.
There's really not a whole lot more to add. She did have an echo. Her EF was about 15%, so her heart was very compromised. Dr. Singer will be happy to know that we checked her vitamin D level. She was vitamin D deficient, so we did replace vitamin D.
Is she still alive?
So this remarkably, yes. So this lady, the main thing we tried to do is initiate our therapy, you know, hit her pretty hard, and then leave her alone. Talked a lot with the ICU team about not diuresing her anymore. She was intubated for almost 2 weeks and in the hospital for another week, and she couldn't sit up. But her family and she insisted that she not go to a skilled nursing facility or rehabilitation center. They wanted to take her home, which we thought was a terrible idea. We ended up seeing her about a month later in clinic, and she was walking. So the family worked very hard with her, and she's doing very well now, and we're sending her for ablation.
Okay. Is her cardiac function improving at all?
She hasn't had a repeat echo
yet. An ejection fraction of 15%, a thyrotoxic cardiomyopathy is a serious consideration.
She hasn't yet had another. Yeah, I'm sure. And we definitely think it was from the thyroid. She hasn't had a repeat echo yet, but that'll be something that we'll
have to look at. And so
hopefully
that'll get better. Yeah, that's impressive.
Yeah, I think the main points we wanted to make are just, like Dr. Singer said, be very careful with diuretics. And also cardioversion in thyrotoxic patients.
So the question is whether the 10 milligrams of methimazole that they gave her in the emergency department was enough for her. No.
With regard to Scott's ad hominem remark about vitamin D, that'll cost you, Scott. I know you're applying for positions as well. I think maybe Mary would disagree. I think we go nuts with all this vitamin D business. It can't be that 75% of people in the United States are vitamin D deficient. Right? We're in sunny Southern California, right?
Okay, we have one last case for you, okay? And this is Rupa Aluwalia from the UK.
Hi, I'm Rupa. I am an endocrine trainee in Liverpool in England. So can you hear me? Yeah. So this is a 25-year-old lady. She was 25 when she initially presented. I came across her recently because her care was transferred under my boss. So when she presented initially, this was 25-year-old West African descent lady, but born in the UK, presented to her GP, which is a primary care physician, with symptoms suggestive of an underactive thyroid gland, i.e. lethargy, malaise, difficulty to lose weight, and irregular periods. The GP ran off some thyroid function tests. Based on those thyroid function tests, she was referred to the secondary care, that is the endocrinology clinic, as suspected secondary hypothyroidism. So I'll come back to the results in a second. But just going back to the lady herself, she was generally otherwise fit and well and didn't have any other medical problems. There was no significant family history. She had a twin sister, who we'll come to in a bit. On examination herself in the endocrinology clinic, she looked clinically, I would say, euthyroid, and her neck examination was normal. Systemic examination was also within normal limits. Coming back to her results, which were done...
Sorry, let me ask a quick question. When you said her examination was normal, could you feel a thyroid gland?
No, there wasn't a palpable...
No palpable thyroid gland.
No.
And was she pretty thin so that your thyroid exam would be pretty accurate? Did she have a thick neck or a thin neck?
No, she had a body mass index of around 31, so okay. She wasn't slim. Coming back to her results, so we repeated them. The results which I have are from the GP, the primary care physician. The results, the tests we ran off in our own hospital as well were pretty consistent. So she had a TSH of 1.2. Our normal range is 0.17 to 3.20, so probably in the mid. Total T4 was 51, and the normal range for us is 50 to 150, so lower end of the normal range. She had a free T4 of 7.6 picomoles per liter, normal range being 10 to 24. So really a low free T4 with probably a normal TSH. And the results were fairly consistent when we repeated the test in our lab. So...
Can I ask you a few more questions about history and physical? She having periods?
Periods were irregular.
I'm sorry, so irregular periods but present. And had she been pregnant any time in the past?
No.
Never been pregnant,
not trying to be pregnant.
Okay. Any headaches, visual?
No. Symptoms? I mean, she was tired, so there wasn't any specific symptoms suggestive of any, sinister symptoms. Like, she could have a headache on occasions, but nothing to have any alarming symptoms regarding the headache. No visual symptoms as such.
Okay. So, and she's 25 normal?
At the time of presentation.
At the time of normal puberty?
Yeah, normal delivery.
Normal growth?
Yeah, adolescence was normal, so nothing to suggest that you might suspect a long-standing problem here.
Okay.
Normal, I can't remember. She's probably 5'3", but that her mom wasn't tall, so nothing you would expect any different.
And no, it sounds like no other medical illnesses, no medications, no illicit drugs, no nothing odd in her system.
No, that's a very important job in UK, so no illicit drugs. No, nothing to suggest. She was West African descent, so allowing that... There was nothing to say that she actually had symptoms suggestive of PCOS. We didn't run a formal PCOS screen, but she certainly didn't have any features of hyperandrogenism. And periods had been regular previously. So, yeah.
You said her menses are irregular or regular?
Irregular.
Irregular.
Regular in the past.
Until when?
So she's giving a couple of years history before she got to the GP about the periods, but her reason for coming to the GP was the energy levels, which was only a couple of months. No. Okay. Should we move on?
No. So, I mean, the first thing, you have a patient, she's still menstruating. I think it'd be unlikely to have secondary hypothyroidism and still have normal menses. So my first impulse, I'm sure you did it, it's going to come back the same, otherwise you wouldn't present the case, would be to repeat the free T4 and TSH. And
yeah, we repeated the test in our lab, this was a different lab from the GP's lab. So
yeah. Okay, so you have a patient who's otherwise, she appears to be clinically euthyroid, the free T4 is not really low. Well, you have different ranges. Yeah, 7.6, 10. So it's modestly low. You have secondary hypothyroidism in someone who's still menstruating. It'd be hard-pressed to all of a sudden catch isolated TSH deficiency, I think. But you have to wonder whether or not there's something going on upstairs. Everything else, her blood count, everything else was normal.
Yeah, routine bloods were normal. We also did a baseline pituitary profile, which was normal.
What is a pituitary profile?
So a baseline pituitary profile would be looking at all the other axes. So we would have done an IGF-1. I don't have the numbers, but they were all within normal range. So an IGF-1, a cortisol, an LH, an FSH, and an estradiol.
And the prolactin was normal.
And the prolactin was normal, of course.
Now, go ahead.
So just an initial comment is that, so this is really the flip side of the case we talked about a few minutes ago, where the thyroid function tests are discordant. They're just discordant in the opposite direction now. You've got, so instead of worrying about central hyperthyroidism, you're worried about central hypothyroidism. And the issue here is that the TSH is normal. She looks normal. She doesn't really give you a history of obvious hypothyroidism. And so one of the decisions you have to make is what is the free T4 real? So is this wacky labs or is this real disease? And in this case, the total T4 and the free T4 are kind of concordant. The total T4 is lowish normal. The free T4 is low. The TSH is normal. So if we're going down the wacky lab situation, I would wonder about that free T4. Again, it's kind of like a broken record here. These free T4 analog assays are subject to some weird findings sometimes, sometimes due to drugs or illicit substances or interfering substances, and sometimes just due to the assay. So I always like to send off the assay to a different lab pretty early before I start a very big pituitary workup. So I would have liked to seen a free T4 done in a different assay. And the one you repeated was different.
It was different. But it uses equilibrium.
You did use equilibrium dialysis. Yes. Okay, so then you start to think, the free T4, not just in a different analog assay, but by a different assay methodology completely, is still low. And therefore, you start going down not the wacky lab algorithm, but the central hypothyroidism algorithm. And as Dr. Singer mentioned, this would be central hypothyroidism, which you don't usually get in an isolated fashion for reasons that we don't understand. When something starts to go wrong with the pituitary gland, a mass lesion, an infiltrative lesion, there's a not invariant but fairly stereotypic sequence of loss of hormones, and so children stop growing because growth hormone is the first thing you lose usually. LH and FSH, the gonadotrophs, usually are the second thing. And so, ACTH and TSH and prolactin are usually fairly well preserved. And again, we don't understand why there's this differential sensitivity to mass and pressure and infiltration effects. So it's not unheard of to have isolated central hypothyroidism without these other pituitary hormone deficiencies, but it would be unusual. And so when something like this is presented to me by my fellows, the first thing I always want to know is if they're having normal menses, because normal menses means a normal gonadal axis, which means that central hypothyroidism is less likely, although not unheard of. She's having irregular menses. She's not having regular menses. And the normal FSH and LH don't rule out some degree of gonadal deficiency. The irregular menses can also be due to hypothyroidism, so not necessarily. But I'm still a little bit hesitant just because she's not showing you a lot of symptoms of hypothyroidism, but certainly her labs are suggesting central hypothyroidism. And the differential diagnosis of that would be a mass lesion, again, less common with isolated lymphocytic hypophysitis, infiltrative lesions, and there's a whole long differential about that. I'm still a little... Yeah. It's tough to get sick euthyroid with a low free T4. So because remember, sick euthyroid is that T3 goes down first when you get sick. And then you have to actually be pretty sick for the free T4 to go down, and you can get some TSH suppression as well. You get some very funny analog free T4 assays with sick euthyroid, but we haven't actually heard that she's sick, and you're suggesting that psychiatric stress could be enough to do that. That would be really unusual. Now, there's something called euthyroid hyperthyroxenemia of acute psychiatric illness, but then the free T4 is transiently elevated, not low. So the problem with... This pattern is consistent with non-thyroidal illness or sick euthyroid syndrome. The problem is we haven't heard anything to suggest that she's sick, and just kind of life stress isn't really enough to do that. So one thing that can do this is anorexia and malnutrition, and I didn't hear anything to say that she's got an eating disorder, but I'm not hearing anything that would suggest that she's sick in order to invoke that.
No, she wasn't sick, and we generally in our history don't ask about life stresses as such, as you said, because people will tell you all their stories, but there was nothing... there was nothing very out of the ordinary which would say that this could be putting everything in picture. So,
well, I was kind of hoping you didn't do a total T4 here, because that's low also, Mary. And if it wasn't low, I'd say, well, the analog free T4 maybe is goofy. That's the circumstance. If that's all you have, that's when you do a total T4 and something that we did in the old days of T3 uptake and calculate a free T4 index, which is unnecessary here because she has a total T4 that matches Mary her. And it's, oh, yeah, right, she had it by dialysis. So the other thing, the IGF-1, it's not a good test. If you're looking, I know you have your pituitary panel or whatever that is, profile, and it's not a good test for growth hormone deficiency, as you know. So we don't ordinarily order it unless we suspect growth hormone excess. I think you're stuck here. I don't think we can invoke antibodies to T4 here. She's got a T4 by equilibrium dialysis. We have to assume this is all normal. So since there's only time for one more case, you're going to have to tell us what the MRI is.
So before the MRI, we did a TRH stimulation test.
Wow, we can't do that anymore.
Okay, and so are you interested in the results? Should we move
on? We are interested, but then we can give. You'll have to give us the background. TRH.
Oh, God, no. So,
do we have time for a story? What was the TRH stimulation test?
So the baseline was 4.1. 20 minutes was 5.8.
4.1 was the baseline?
Yeah.
Of what? The free T4?
No, the TSH.
TSH, I'm sorry.
Yeah. The 20-minute is 5.8, and the 60-minute is 3.
Okay. Does anyone know what this means? It's blunted.
It's blunted response,
okay. Has anyone here used TRH? TRH is this, Mary has. It's this little of course it is. That's redundant. It's a tripeptide, glutamine, histidine, proline. And it was first characterized in 1967 by Shally and Guillemin. Shally and Bowers, actually. And then Roger Guillemin first was able to synthesize it. They characterized it by getting all these sheep, and this was in Texas, they did this in Houston. They got 200,000 sheep hypothalami and were able to get about 2 or 3 milligrams of TRH. Anybody still awake here? And then started doing these studies. And then Guillemin synthesized it, got the Nobel Prize, that he shared with Shally for this. It was the first hypothalamic peptide actually synthesized, characterized and synthesized, and the reason was because it's only 3 amino acids. They had suspected for years that there was a hypothalamic peptide controlling ACTH, and when that was finally characterized, I think it was 39 amino acids, so it took a lot longer to characterize that one. So it was first used for the kind of thing you're doing to differentiate pituitary from from hypothalamic disease by injecting this little peptide, and within minutes you get an increase in TSH. If the TSH stayed flat, you know it was in the pituitary. If you got a response, then it had to be hypothalamic, except if it's a chronic situation. Now, this was a short TRH test that you did, and if you did it repetitively, it's conceivable that you might have now started to get a rise. So, quite frankly, while it's blunted, as Mary says, I can't tell you whether this is hypothalamic or pituitary. I suspect, however, because it's not normal, I suspect, however, that it may be hypothalamic.
She's actually had serial TRH tests, but later on. But should I tell you about the MRI finding?
Well, the MRI, now that we suspect it's hypothalamic, right, Mary? No? No, Mary disagrees. So, all right. We're going to have a hypothalamic pituitary smackdown now. And so... So how are we going to resolve this, Mary? What do you think the MRI shows?
That's a blunted TRH stim test, and the thyrotrophs for some reason aren't responding to TRH, which is either that they're dead or dying or something like that, or stunned or asleep or atrophic because they haven't had a lot of TRH stimulation. So it turns out that, all joking aside, that the TRH stim test, although it was used for to distinguish in central hypothyroidism hypothalamic versus pituitary disease, it actually didn't correlate all that well with the anatomy when you go in there and you look by CT scan or MRI. And so it was kind of a fun academic thing to do, but it didn't actually make a difference. You still had to image the head, and you still had to know what was going on in there. So I'm actually going to, rather than go by the TRH test, I'm actually playing the odds and saying that if this is central hypothyroidism, and there are just more pituitary things that can cause this rather than hypothalamic things. So I actually don't know, but she needs an MRI.
What you said is pituitary. All right, and so I'm going to say, just for the sake of argument, because I don't know, I really don't know, but Mary mentioned a disorder. She has no kids. You had mentioned a possibility of lymphocytic hypophysitis, didn't you? Yeah, but...
No. No polyuria, no polydipsia.
So again, DI would be more common with stalk lesions or hypothalamic lesions, and very unusual with primary pituitary lesions, even if they're big. So, I don't know.
Would you expect isolated TSH deficiency?
But you can have hypothalamic... I mean, you're going to tell us maybe the pituitary stalk's a bit thickened, but you can have... histiocytosis X without diabetes insipidus. If you are if you have sarcoid, you probably will have DI. But you could still have this weird thing, histiocytosis X. You can also have lymphocytic hypophysitis, although it'd be unusual if it's not postpartum, have TSH deficiency associated with that. Right. Question? Okay.
Yeah. So the MRI pituitary shows an asymmetrically enlarged pituitary gland almost abutting the chiasm. There is no nodular appearance, and it's been reported as pituitary hyperplasia. Hyperplasia. There is no bright spot, and the stalk is essentially doesn't look any different. So.
Well, if it's hyperplasia without a tumor, it could still be hypophysitis. Which should resolve. Do you have any follow-up?
We've done follow-up imaging. It's completely unchanged. Okay, the twin sister very soon presents with very similar symptoms and a very similar set of TFTs and a very similar MRI finding. And both twin sisters are on levothyroxine, which is now being changed to leothyronine because they both seem to not tolerate levothyroxine. They have weird symptoms such as they get more tired and then they say they have some GI symptoms and then they do better on leothyronine, so they both are on it. The only mutation, this presented a long time ago. I've only seen her recently because she changed firms. But when she presented at that time, it was, I think, late 90s, is what happened is the only mutation which they could do for central hypothyroidism was a TSH beta gene. She was tested for that. Both sisters are negative for the mutation. And since I've seen her, I've read up some reviews. There's recently been a paper and which has actually picked up more mutations and reported. And so these both the sisters are now going for a joint consultation with our clinical geneticists who I've been in touch with, because there is something called a PIT1, a PROP1, and a TRH receptor gene as well, which they could be tested for. So, So we think this is the, because there, I don't know, I think just 2 months ago, JCEM had a picture case where there is reversible pituitary hyperplasia with primary hypothyroidism, which is very well known. We think from the literature search that I've done and my colleagues have done, there is no case of pituitary hyperplasia with secondary hypothyroidism, especially in twins. So, yes. And suggest you as a reviewer then.
Okay. I just want to thank Mary and Peter, and that was a great discussion. And thank you to the fellows who all submitted cases. That was great. Thank you.